For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Book of Judges. Again, a quick little recap for those of you that have not been with us. This book is very old, and it covers one of the darkest times in the history of Israel. The Dark Ages, if you will. It's about a 300-year period, starting in about 1370 BC. And, you know, at this time, there was no king in Israel. And everybody pretty much did what they wanted to. Everybody did what was right in their own eyes is one of the common refrains that occurs more repeatedly as the book goes on. And it was a pretty bad time. We've seen this cycle where the people of Israel, they forget about God, and then God says, okay, I'm going to allow you to be conquered by some other surrounding nation. And so these nations would come in and they would oppress them for some period of time, 5, 10, 20 years. People would cry out to God, and then God would send a deliverer, also otherwise known as a judge. And these judges, men and women, would lead the people to freedom. And they would enjoy some period of freedom for a few years, sometimes several years. And then they again would forget about God, and the cycle would repeat itself again. And what we've seen as we've gone along through this book is that the cycle is not simply repeating itself, it's getting worse. The people get worse, the oppression gets longer, the people seem to care less and less, and even the judges seem to be getting worse and worse. You know, it's like at the beginning, the stories, you know, there was kind of this happy, victorious feel to them, but as they've gone along, it just gets darker and darker. And, you know, even when God delivers the people, the deliverance is overshadowed by some just disgusting sin in the life of the judge. Whether it's the massacre of Gideon or the probable human sacrifice of Jephthah. And so we're spiraling downward, and when we come to Samson, the final judge in this book and the final cycle, we've truly saved the best for last. And when I say best, I mean worst. you know, they hit rock bottom in every way in this final cycle, the story of Samson. And how God still, you know, even in spite of how bad this is, you still see God shining through. And it's almost like the darkness just makes the light of God even shine through even brighter as we see his salvation coming to his people and him working through really, really messed up situations. And so we're going to get into the life of Samson tonight. Starting in Judges chapter 13, we read, again, the Israelites did evil in the Lord's sight. So the Lord handed them over to the Philistines, who oppressed them for 40 years. So again, they do evil. God hands them over to an oppressor, the Philistines this time. And 40 years, that is by far the longest period of oppression in the whole book of Judges. It's like double the longest period so far. And, you know, one thing that's missing here from this cycle that's in all the other cycles is usually at this point, what happens? People cry out to God, right? And then God sends a deliverer. Well, here in Judges 13, in the story of Samson, there is no cry. The people don't even seem to care that they're being cruelly ground under the heel of the Philistines. They seem content pretty much to coexist with them, to try and get along with them, to try to keep them from getting angry at them. And they're just totally compromised. We enter a scene of complete apathy here when we get to Judges chapter 13. And so even though the people don't cry out to God, even though they don't even ask for his help, God decides to intervene anyway and to send another deliverer. In those days, a man named Manoah from the tribe of Dan lived in the town of Zorah. His wife was unable to become pregnant, and they had no children, obviously. The angel of the Lord appeared to Manoah's wife and said, "Even though you have been unable to have children, you will soon become pregnant and give birth to a son. So be careful. You must not drink wine or any other alcoholic drink, nor eat any forbidden food. You will become pregnant and give birth to a son, and his hair will never be cut, for he will be dedicated to God as a Nazarite from birth. And he will begin to rescue Israel from the Philistines." So the angel makes two promises here to this woman, the wife of Manoah. The first promise is, even though you can't have kids, you're going to have a kid. So we have a miraculous birth foretold. And this is one of just a handful of occasions in the Bible where an angel shows up and foretells the birth of a child. And this is usually pretty good news. In every one of these cases, the child that's born turns out to be this powerful man of God, used powerfully in God's plan. And so things are looking good for this kid. Just the fanfare that surrounds his birth. She does give him, regarding this child that the angel says will be born, he gives her some specific instructions. He says that he will be a Nazarite from birth. A Nazarite. What does that mean? Well, we read more about this in Numbers chapter 6. This was actually a vow that people could take. A Nazarite. The word Nazarite just means dedicated or set apart. So he will just be a dedicated one or a consecrated one, a set apart one from birth. And there were three specific things that three specific vows that a Nazarite would commit to. First of all, no wine or grape products. So that includes raisins, raisin bran, things like that. No touching dead people. And third and finally, no haircuts. It's kind of a random collection there, isn't it? It's not really clear why these three things are picked. I mean, it's I think it's kind of like don't associate with death because, you know, dead people is obviously death. But haircut is kind of like chopping the hair off and the hair's dead then. And then wine is like fermentation and whatnot. So it's probably something to do with staying away, not being defiled or rendered unclean by death. And so the people, they would take one of these vows voluntarily, didn't have to, and they just feel like, I want to do this, I want to set myself apart for a little while. It'd be a predetermined period of time. They would fulfill the vow, chop off the hair, offer it up to God, and go back to life as usual. And you can see some of the things that he's saying. You know, when he says, you must not drink wine or any other alcoholic drink, this is not like, he's not like worried about fetal alcohol syndrome. He's just saying, you know, you're kind of lumped into this Nazarite vow as well, because whatever you drink, is the baby's going to get a little bit of that. And so you can see, no haircutting, no alcohol. There were a couple differences, though, with Samson's Nazarite vow that are not found in normal Nazarite vows. One, this is divinely imposed. It wasn't a voluntary thing. It wasn't something he decided to do. It was something God thought he should do. Also, this one starts at not just birth, really. It starts at conception. From an embryonic age, Samson is a Nazarite. And so that's obviously a lot earlier than anyone else would have had a Nazarite vow. And then finally, it's permanent. It's from conception to death. Samson is supposed to be a Nazarite. So he's supposed to commit to these three things. No alcohol, no touching dead bodies, and no cutting your hair. The second thing that is promised here is not just that she's going to have a child, but this child will begin to rescue Israel from the Philistines. So this is a little different than the other judges, right? The other judges actually rescued Israel from whatever oppressor was, you know, in charge at that time. Whereas Samson, it just says he'll begin to do that. So it's like a partial deliverance, which it's a little surprising. You'd think that the fact that there's so much anticipation surrounding his birth, it seems like this guy's going to do more than all the rest, but in actuality, he's not going to do as much as all the rest. He won't be as successful. The delivery won't be as complete. And the Philistines will need to be fully, Israel will need to be fully delivered after the life of Samson or by someone else. Well, this is real exciting news. The woman immediately ran and told her husband everything that had happened. And her husband, Manoah, hears about this, and he prays to the Lord. He says, Lord, please let the man of God come back to us again and give us more instructions about this son who is to be born. It's like, what are you talking about? He already gave some pretty clear instructions. You kind of get the sense that Manoah here is a little bit irked that the angel appeared to his wife and not to him. You know, he's like, let the man of God come back to us and tell us some more things about this child. And, you know, he had to be wondering, okay, honey, you're barren your whole life, and now God came to you and told you that we're going to have a child, not just any child, but one that's going to, like, be a conqueror of the Philistines. Right. So he says, why don't you come back again, God, and give us some more instructions. Give old Manoah some instructions. So God answered the prayer and appeared again to his wife. Well, immediately she ran and told her husband, "The man who appeared to me the other day is here again." So Manoah ran back with his wife out into the field where she was. And he says, "Are you the man who spoke to my wife the other day?" "Yeah, I am." Okay, next question. So Manoah asked him, when your words come true, what kind of rules should govern the boy's life and work? Is there anything specific we should do for this boy?" And he's like, be sure to, your wife follows the instructions I gave her. No grapes, raisins, wine, alcohol, no forbidden food." As you can tell, the angel's not too impressed with Manoah here. And no matter how much Manoah tries to control the conversation, the angel is just kind of unflappable, just saying what needs to be said. Manoah's like, can I get you something to eat?" And the guy's like, "Well, seeing that I'm the angel of the Lord, I don't really need to eat. But if you want to bring me a sacrifice or something, that'd be fine." So he brings a sacrifice. He took a young goat and a grain offering and offered it on a rock as a sacrifice to the Lord. And as Manoah and his wife watched, the Lord did an amazing thing. As the flames from the altar shot up toward the sky, the angel of the Lord ascended in the fire. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell with their faces to the ground. The angel did not appear again to Manoah and his wife, and Manoah finally realized it was the angel of the Lord. This is kind of like that scene with Gideon, where the angel appears to him and accepts his sacrifice. And Manoah responds the same way. He says to his wife, "We're going to die because we've seen God." And his wife said, "If the Lord was going to kill us, I don't think he would have accepted our burnt offering and grain offering. And he wouldn't have appeared to us, told us this wonderful thing, done all these miracles. I mean, how are we going to have a kid if he kills us?" And he's like, "Yeah, you make a pretty good point there, hon." like we saw with Gideon, God accepts the sacrifice. God accepts the sacrificer. He was right that they deserved to die. I mean, he knew, he had this internal sense of guilt. And he knew that just being in the presence of God meant that, just to be exposed to pure goodness and pure holiness, he realized that's enough to kill a man. The whole point of the sacrifice is instead of God taking the person, God takes the sacrifice and it symbolically substitutes for the sacrificer. And so it says that she names the son is born, just like the angel said, and she named him Samson. And the Lord blessed him as he grew up. And so she picks the name Samson. Doesn't appear anywhere else in the Bible. The word Samson literally means little son. Okay? Like S-U-N, like the sun. And why did she pick this name? I think the most charitable interpretation would be that Samson, this is like a really dark time in the history of Israel, and Samson is like this light shining into this dark time, a ray of hope bursting through where there just is no other hope. But you also got to consider the fact that their hometown was like 2 miles from this major center of the solar cult, where people would actually worship the sun. Okay? And so it's pretty weird. Even if she didn't mean this in honor of the sun god, you still don't name your kid that. I mean, what are you going to say? "Hey, let's all follow the sun god into victory, and he will lead us to victory over the Philistines." You don't name the kid God gave you after the other local deity. And it's like naming him Little Buddha or something like that. I mean, maybe he's got a belly, but still, you steer clear of other God names for your kid that God gives you. So that's questionable. And you kind of get a feel for the spiritual climate into which Samson was born. Throughout this chapter, there's just a dullness, an insensitivity. He says he's a Nazarite. Manoah's like, "A what? Can you come back and re-explain this to us?" It's like they just are not even familiar with the Word of God at all. And they don't even seem to be that upset. Like I said, they don't even seem to be that upset about the fact that the Philistines are ruling over them. And yet, in spite of these things, God blessed Samson as he grew up. And it says in verse 25, "The Spirit of the Lord began to stir him while he lived in Mahanaim, Dan. which is located between the towns of Zorah and Eshtaol. And so as Samson is growing up, it says the Spirit of God began to stir him, kind of began to arouse him, to kind of poke at him, to prod him, to let him know that God is there. He began to do something in his life. And this is not like other times where we see the Spirit of God come upon the judge and they do some sort of like heroic feat. You know, this time here, it seems like it's more of a long-term process where God is stirring within Samson, using his Spirit. And, you know, again, like we said, this is an apathetic time, a time of great compromise where nobody even seems to care. And God is saying, you know, Samson is not going to be one of these people. He's not going to get sucked right back down into the apathy of the age in which he lives. So God begins stirring in Samson's heart. And, you know, God's in kind of a strange position here. Because God has the desire to deliver his people. He has the power to deliver his people. He's already provided the deliverer. And yet, the people don't really want to be delivered. So what do you do in that situation? What should God do when people don't want his salvation? He's not going to force himself on people. I think many of us have probably learned you can't make somebody love you. You can't force someone to let you be involved in their life. And so what is God going to do? Well, God has his ways of raising the need level, the hunger level in our lives. And he does that really through two primary avenues in our lives and in this story of Samson. One, circumstances. You know, when we set a life direction that is the opposite way, away from God, that's going to end poorly. You know, God doesn't really need to divinely intervene. He can just let cause and effect run its course, and we're going to see that our life is miserable and bad, and I shouldn't have headed fundamentally the opposite way that God wanted me to head. And so sometimes it's just cause and effect. Sometimes God will actively engineer circumstances in your life. To the point where he's specifically placing people and events and even sometimes failure in your life to try and get your attention, to show you that everything you think is going to make you happy isn't. You know, I mean, that's what he did in my life. I always thought if I just have a girlfriend and cool friends and success in school, then I'm going to be happy. And when I got all those things, I realized I'm more depressed than when I started. And then when I lost several of those things, it just sent me even deeper into a depression. And it's at that point that I started calling out to God. I started realizing, man, my way of living is just not going to cut it. And so sometimes God will engineer circumstances. You know, he might be doing that with people here tonight. Engineering circumstances that are showing you how bankrupt your way of living is. And communicating to you that this is just going to keep getting worse. Unless you get a new God, unless you get a new direction for your life. So sometimes it's circumstances, and we'll see that over the next two chapters that we'll study here tonight, God just intervenes in a couple key places, and then just lets cause and effect play out. And he manages to throw the proverbial monkey wrench in this system that just seems to be going along this smooth system of compromise. God stirs things up. Pretty violently, actually, as we'll see. And so in some cases, he's using circumstances to stir. In other cases, he's actually using his Spirit to stir people up. This can work in conjunction with circumstances. Sometimes the Spirit of God actually highlights, he calls your attention to specific things in your life. But sometimes the Spirit of God, he starts talking to you. He starts telling you, God is here. God is real. You know, you start having these questions about spiritual things. God, you know, puts a friend in your life who is real into spiritual things. And that person just wants to talk about that with you. Probably more than you even want to talk about it with them. And so, you know, there's these subtle ways that the Spirit of God will stir. He'll show you, you've got a problem here. You're ignoring God. You can't keep running from God. You know, and maybe it's real subtle things like you're looking out at nature, maybe you're looking up at the stars, and you just think, there is no way that the human race is just chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet, in the words of Stephen Hawking. There's no way that this is some sort of a chemical accident, you know, doomed to just burn itself out and have no significance at all. You know, you look out and you realize God's there. God's real. And that's God saying to you, I'm here. Or, you know, maybe you kind of get worked up about some of the evil, the problems happening in the world. But then you start to realize, you know, where am I even getting this sense of right and wrong? How am I determining that certain things are wrong? It's like I'm appealing to some standard that is outside of me and anything else. What am I even appealing to here? How can I even call something right or wrong? That's God saying, I'm here. I'm the one that put that sense in you. Or even, you feel internal pangs of guilt when you do something that you know is wrong. Maybe it's you've only broken one of your own man-made rules. And yet still, you realize, man, this is a problem. You feel torn internally. And you know that the Spirit of God, or you come to a teaching like this, and you hear God repeating back to you your secret thoughts, the questions you've never told anybody, the things you think when you're lying awake at night. And you hear God playing on those. Because God is there. He's listening to you. And he's trying to communicate to you, I'm here. I'm real. I like how Christ put it. He says the Spirit will convict the world concerning sin and righteousness and judgment. You know, it's a pretty broad job that God's Spirit has in convicting people and in moving into people's lives and in turning them toward God and getting them to face the issue. You know, he says concerning sin, basically showing people what's wrong, what's evil. You know, this is wrong and you know it. Concerning righteousness, so also telling people what right is. And concerning judgment, meaning you do more wrong than you do right. And God's got a problem with that. We've got this internal sense that God has a problem with me, and we're trying to run from it. But the truth is that you have done. You haven't met God's perfect standard of righteousness. And that's the bad news. You know, that's ultimately what the Spirit is conveying to the whole human race, according to Jesus. But at the same time, there's some good news as well. And the good news is that Jesus Christ was God and still is God. And he came into earth as a human being. And he committed no sin. He was perfectly good and righteous. And yet, he deserved no judgment, but he took the judgment that you and I deserved. And so this internal sense that people have that God's got a problem with me, it's true. But God also has a solution for you. And what the Bible says is that anybody who receives forgiveness from Christ, free of charge, can pass out of judgment and into life. And, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you might have to admit, that's the reason I really can't admit that God is there. It's because deep down, I know God's got a problem with me, and I'm worried about what would really the implications be if I admitted that there really is a God. And the other thing about when the Spirit of God begins to stir someone, you can't remain in the same place. You've either got to listen and respond and move toward God, or you've got to plug your ears and turn your back and stiffen your neck and walk away from God. Okay? It has this polarizing effect on people where they can't just settle for this compromised life that so many had settled for. God was determined that Samson was going to fight, okay? And that, whether that be walking with God or running the other way, God was going to use Samson to begin to deliver his people. You know, Samson's response to God, that's going to be a large determining factor on how God works through him. But God had decided, I'm going to use this guy one way or another. And he begins to stir, he begins to put pressure, he begins to involve himself in Samson's life. And let's read on and see how Samson responds to the stirring of God. Judges 14, verse 1. One day, Samson was in Timnah. One of the Philistine women caught his eye. Well, that's a bad start. Timnah, a Philistine city. What is he doing hanging out with the Philistines? What is he doing? I mean, is he just running? Is he running from God or something like that? It almost seems like he's trying to get away from God and the people of God and just hang out with the Philistines. You know, so he's not just hanging out with them. He's like checking out their women. And one of them caught his eye. You know, he's like, yeah, she looks pretty good. When he returned home, he told his mother and father, a young Philistine woman in Timnah caught my eye. I want to marry her. Go get her for me. Doesn't even know her name. Never talked to her, probably. He says, I want to marry her. Go. Okay, so not only is he hanging out with the Philistines and checking out their women, he's wanting to marry them. And, you know, he has this blunt interaction with his parents. He's just like, I want her. Go get her. I mean, what's his criteria for marriage? Why is it that he wants to marry this woman? Well, I saw her, and I want her, and I'm going to get her. That seems to be Samson's entire reason. He's like a beast. You know, there's no reason, there's no higher level thinking here. He's operating at an instinctual level here. His father and mother objected. Isn't there even one woman in our tribe or among all the Israelites you could marry, they asked? Why must you go to the pagan Philistines to find a wife? Isn't there a single woman? Come on. But Samson told his father, get her for me. She looks good to me. It's like reasoning with Tarzan or something. And this phrase, she looks good to me, that literally says, she is right in my eyes. And the author is deliberately playing on a larger theme in this book. You know, in Israel at this time, everybody's just doing what's right in their own eyes. And Samson just typifies the spirit of the age, doesn't he? He sees someone catches his eye. He wants her. You know, it's his feelings, his vision, his senses. This is how he determines what he should do. There's no consideration here about what does God want? What is God doing? What does God want for my life? You know, I mean, these are the people he's supposed to conquer. And he wants to join himself for the rest of his life to one of them. That's a major conflict of interest. And you see this this attitude, you know, you see this playing out in the way he dishonors his parents. I mean, that's a disturbing interaction, this the initial two interactions with his parents. Just rude, bossy, he doesn't care. He just wants what he wants. He seems disgusted with any objections. And, you know, this is even extreme for today, but for the culture of the time, which had a very strong ethos of honoring your parents, this would have been even more out of place. And it makes you kind of wonder, how long has this pattern been going on? You know, I get the impression this has been going on for a long time. And it's not just something that develops overnight. And, you know, I don't know why Samson ended up this way. I got a theory, though, I'm going to share with you guys. And if you think about it, what we know about Samson, he was the miracle child, the baby who was never supposed to be born, and yet God gave them a child. And this wasn't just any child. It was foretold by an angel. You know, he had a special vow, a special purpose, and a prophecy that said that he's going to be the deliverer. He was a hero, a conqueror. And, you know, I get the impression that this story with the angel, this was deeply burned into Samson's mind, as well as his parents and probably their relatives. And you get the impression that when Samson was a kid, their philosophy is, well, Samson is special, and so let's not cross Samson. Let's just give Samson whatever he wants. You know, Samson just has all the marks of somebody that has never been told no. No boundaries have ever been set up with him. He's a powerful man. He's a strong man, as we'll see. And this is a dangerous combination because nobody outside of Samson is going to stop Samson. And if Samson can't stop himself internally, if Samson has no self-control, if he's just driven by whatever he feels, that's going to be bad news for somebody. And so, you know, Samson, it just seems like a guy that always got what he wanted, you know, like the jock in high school or something like that, or the pro athlete. You know, women want him, guys want to be like him, people just give him whatever he wants. And so here you see his parents, you know, they put up a little bit of a objection, but they're very quickly steamrolled by his short temper tantrum. And they realize we just shut up and give him what he wants. That's what we've always done. And so you see how this, you know, he just, whatever he wants, he just rolls right over his parents, casts them to the side. You also see this in his poor marriage choice. Again, like I said, there's no consideration of what God might want. It's, she looks good. I want her. I'm going to go get her. And if anybody raises any objections, I'll get angry until they get out of my way. And, you know, he's joining his life to an unbeliever, to the people that are oppressing the people of God. And, you know, it's hard when you see somebody doing something like this. You know, I think this applies to any choice that we're just strong-headed, willfully heading the opposite direction that God wants us to head. But I think especially with things like marriage choices where it's like, you know, people just get so confused. They're like, well, you know, nobody really understands her. And deep down, she really does want to follow God. It's just, you know, I'm the only one that really understands her. Or, you know, I've been sharing my faith with him, and I think he's close to believing in God, and I'm sure that once we get married, he'll become a strong man of God. And, you know, it's like you're sitting up on a cliff. You know, you're sitting up on a hill watching this train just headed full steam down the tracks, and you can look up and you can see there's no bridge over that cliff that it's heading toward. And no matter what you say, they don't want to listen. They're just plowing forward, you know, busting through the sign that says track ends 1,000 feet, track ends 500 feet, track ends 100 feet. And it's like they're determined to just run right off that cliff. Hoping maybe that they'll land on some tracks at the bottom or something like that. And ignoring the fact that it's probably going to end real bad. It's probably going to be a train wreck. And Samson will see his life accelerates faster and faster and faster until it ends completely in shambles. A massive train wreck. And so he's living life through by the thesis, whatever is right in my eyes, that's what I'm going to do. And we see this immediately as an adult playing out with his family and with his wife-to-be, apparently. Well, his father and mother, this is kind of a strange verse. His father and mother didn't realize the Lord was at work in this, creating an opportunity to work against the Philistines who ruled over Israel at that time. So this is kind of weird because, you know, Samson is obviously strong-headedly disobeying, you know, God, by marrying one of the people that he's supposed to be delivering Israel from. And yet at the same time, God is somehow working through this. And you know, God could have delivered the Israelites any number of ways, and he could have done it any number of ways through Samson. But he knew this is the way Samson is. He didn't make Samson a stubborn, rebellious, strong-headed guy. Samson made himself that way. You know, God moved into Samson's life, and apparently Samson just ran farther and farther the other way. And so God says, okay, well, I'm going to still work through you here. And I see an opportunity here. I see an opportunity to break the status quo, to break the apathy and compromise. And he's like, you know, if the Israelites won't fight the Philistines, then maybe the Philistines will fight the Israelites. Well, as Samson and his parents were going down to Timnah, a young lion suddenly attacked Samson near the vineyards of Timnah. And so, you know, they're headed down to meet the parents. And then all of a sudden, out of nowhere, this lion just attacks. Samson had gotten separated from his parents, apparently. And this lion leaps out of the bushes at him. It says, at that moment, the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon him, and he ripped the lion's jaws apart with his bare hands. And so, you know, almost instinctually, Samson just kind of reaches up and grabs this lion's mouth and just rips it, just rips his face open, essentially. Before he even realized what was happening, I'm sure. And so he's standing there, heart beating fast, sweat all over him, holding like two halves of a lion mouth in his hand. There's a corpse there on the ground. Man, that was unexpected. But God protected him. God's spirit quickly came upon him and protected Samson because he had a purpose for this guy. He did it as easily as if it were a young goat. I think we all know how easy that is to tear a young goat's face open. It was just that easy. But he didn't tell his father or mother about it. Now, that's kind of weird. I would be bragging about that if I ripped the lion's face open. Why not? Well, you remember his vow? Remember one of the qualifications in that vow? One of the things he committed to, no touching dead bodies. And he obviously touches a corpse here. And, you know, it wasn't like the game was over if you touched a dead body, but there was a purification ceremony that he was supposed to go through. It was kind of lengthy. There was a cost involved. And Samson's like, well, you know, that's a big pain. And I'm going to meet my future wife. I'm getting married. That just isn't very convenient for me. I don't have time for this right now. So I'm just going to keep this hush-hush. So he heads back out of the vineyard to join up with the rest of the party, probably, you know, probably to clean some blood off his clothes and freshen up a little bit. And it says, when Samson arrived in Timnah, he talked with the woman, and he was very pleased with her. And that, again, she was right in his eyes. And so Samson's like, oh, yeah. I am becoming more and more confident that this is the right decision to make, especially now that I've had a conversation with her. She's definitely the woman I want to spend the rest of my life with. So they returned later for the wedding, and he turned off the path to look at the carcass of the lion and found that a swarm of bees had made some honey in the carcass. Well, this was highly unusual. Usually there would have been maggots or flies in there. The corpse would have had to dry out real quick for bees to be able to get in there and build a hive. And he scooped some of the honey into his hands and ate it along the way. He also gave some to his father and mother, and they ate it. But he did not tell them that he had taken the honey from the carcass of the lion. So again, the touching of the dead body. Again, the secrecy, the lying. You know, here he defiles his parents as well without them even knowing it. That honey would have made them unclean for them to eat it. As his father was making final arrangements for their marriage, Samson threw a party at Timnah. It was the custom for elite young men. Kind of a bachelor party. When the bride's parents saw him, they selected 30 men from the town to be his companions. And so, you know, Samson, it doesn't look like he had any friends. He's hanging out with the Philistines all the time. And really, even more than that, we see Samson alone quite a bit of the time. And so they give him some friends. And Samson says to them, let me tell you a riddle. If you solve my riddle during these 7 days of the celebration, I will give you 30 fine linen robes and 30 sets of festive clothing. And so there were 7 days here to the celebration. And the way Hebrew marriages worked is they'd have a huge party with lots of wine for 7 days. And then on the seventh day, the bride and groom, they would consummate the marriage and they would, you know, live happily ever after. And this word for celebration, this literally means this festival with tons of drinking. And again, the careful reader will notice, wasn't there something about no drinking wine before? This looks like strike two for Samson. He almost certainly would have been drinking at this festival here. And, you know, he's like, well, it's my wedding. I'm going to have a good time. Who cares about that vow anyway? I've already been touching dead bodies for several weeks now. Nothing seems to have happened. Maybe it's a pretty loose enforcement. He says, but if you can't solve my riddle, then you must give me 30 fine linen robes and 30 sets of festive clothing. All right, they agreed. Let's hear your riddle. So he said, out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Well, there's no way they're going to get this one. How are they going to guess a lion with a bee's nest inside of it? And 3 days later, they were still trying to figure this thing out. So they're halfway through the wedding, and they have not gotten it yet. Nobody even has a clue. So on the fourth day, they go to his wife. They say, entice your husband to explain the riddle for us, or we'll burn down your father's house with you in it. Did you invite us to this party just to make us poor? This must have been expensive wardrobe that they were talking about here. And so this threat to Samson's wife. And so Samson's wife came to him in tears and said, you don't love me. You hate me. You've given my people a riddle, but you haven't even told me the answer. Samson's like, what the hell is this? He's like, honey, I haven't even given the answer to my father or mother. Why should I tell you? Kind of a rude response. Shows her where she fits in the family. Number three. And so she cried whenever she was with him and kept it up for the rest of the celebration, nonstop crying, trying to manipulate this guy. At last, on the seventh day, he told her because, the answer because she was tormenting him with her nagging. And I don't think it's a coincidence that she wins on the same day they're supposed to consummate the marriage, if you know what I mean. So she hustles off before sundown and explains the riddle to the young men. So before sunset on the seventh day, the men of the town came to Samson with their answer. So Samson shows up. He's like, all right, boys, go ahead and admit there's no way you got this right. Where's my clothes? And they say, not so fast, Samson. We've actually got a riddle for you. It's like, what? They're like, what is sweeter than honey, and what is stronger than a lion? And you can just see the anger welling up in Samson as he realizes he's been sold out by his own wife. What's the answer to that riddle? Samson's wife. Sweeter than honey and strong enough to take down the mighty Samson. You see, Samson could take down any man, any army, and yet he's laid waste at the hands of women throughout his life. And Samson replied, if you hadn't plowed with my heifer, you wouldn't have solved my riddle. And just so you know, back then, heifer was an insult. If you called your wife a heifer, that was bad. So Samson's like, well, it looks like I need to do a little bit of shopping, doesn't it? And the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon him. And he went down to the town of Ashkelon, another Philistine city, and he killed 30 men, took their belongings, and gave their clothing to the men who solved his riddle. Gives a new meaning to the term shopping spree. You know, may have been torn and bloody from the Philistine corpses he pulled them off of. And still, that didn't stop his anger. Samson was furious about what had happened, and he went back home to live with his father and mother. Just completely leaves his wife. And so his wife was given in marriage to the man who had been Samson's best man at the wedding. So this is already a complete disaster, and we're only halfway done. Let's recap what we've seen so far in this chapter. We are going to cover chapter 15, but not 16 tonight, so I'll be quick here. Samson is disrespectful of his parents, callous toward his calling, without any loyalty to his own people, compromising in his ethic, rude to his wife, flippant with his tongue, driven by lust, eroticism, and appetite. The only way in which good can come from this man is by Yahweh overpowering him with his spirit and driving him to the task of delivering his people, something he's not naturally inclined to do. But this is the weird thing. God is in control. The story ends exactly where he wanted it. At the end of this chapter, the work against the Philistines has begun. Samson's back home, and the adventure in mixed marriage has collapsed. The woman has betrayed her husband. The husband is calling wife disparaging names, and the father-in-law has given the daughter to another man. What was planned as an interracial marriage turns into war. So things are escalating. Fast forward a few months later. Later on during the wheat harvest, Samson starts feeling bad. Decides to go try and make things right with his wife. He hadn't heard about the best man thing. He takes a young goat to present to his wife. You know, some guys bring flowers. Samson brings a goat. Here, honey. He said, I'm going to go into my wife's room to sleep with her. But her father wouldn't let him in. He's like, what? And dad's like, well, there's kind of another guy in there already. I truly thought you must hate her, her father explained, so I gave her in marriage to your best man. But look, her younger sister is even more beautiful than she is. Marry her instead. Samson's like, why did you think I didn't want to marry her? Dad's like, well, you called her a heifer, and then you killed 30 guys, and then you fled town for a couple months. So we already had the wedding going. I just figured that we should marry him to that guy. And, you know, this offer of the younger sister, seems like Samson would be into that. He's a guy that likes what looks good to him. But on the other hand, nobody's going to tell Samson who he should marry. And Samson gets angry. He says, this time I cannot be blamed for everything I'm going to do to you Philistines. Angry Samson. Then he went out and he caught 300 foxes and he tied their tails together in pairs. This is creative. He fastened a torch to each pair of tails. And then he lit the torches and let the foxes run through the grain fields. I mean, this is not a guy punching a wall. This is premeditated, diabolical stuff here. Takes them out. He's like, finally, we're even. Burned all their grain to the ground, including the sheaves and the uncut grain. He also destroyed their vineyards and olive groves. Who did this? The Philistines demanded. Samson was the reply, because, well, his father-in-law gave his wife to the best man. So the Philistines went and got the woman and her father and burned them to death. It escalates. Finally, we're even with Samson. Because you did this, Samson vowed, I won't rest until I take my revenge on you. And that literally, you know, the, I won't rest. He's literally saying, after this, then I'll quit. So he attacked the Philistines with great fury and killed many of them. And then he went to live in a cave in the rock of Etam. And so who knows how many he killed here, but he, again, just goes ballistic and starts killing. The Philistines retaliate by setting up camp in Judah and spreading out near the town of Lehi. So they actually invade Israel. They send the whole army in. The men of Judah asked, why are you attacking us? The Philistines replied, we've come to capture Samson. We've come to pay him back for what he did to us. And so again, the revenge is just spiraling out of control as each party tries to get the other one back and then quit. We basically have an invasion now. We've got an all-out war on our hands. So 3,000 men of Judah went down to get Samson at the cave in the rock of Etam. And again, Samson just, it seems like he's getting lonelier and lonelier as his rage, his selfishness, his insistence on doing whatever's right in his own eyes drives him farther and farther and farther from people. And here he is living by himself in a cave. 3,000 men show up to get him. Now this is the point in the book of Judges where we would expect the Spirit to come on Samson and for him to lead the army to cast out the invaders. And that's not what happens at all. They said, don't you realize the Philistines rule over us? What are you trying to do to us? Again, they've accepted this rule. They're not fighting it at all. Samson replied, I only did to them what they did to me. And the men of Judah said, we've come to tie you up and hand you over to the Philistines. They don't want to fight. They just want to take God's deliverer, tie him up, and gift wrap him, and send him back to the enemy. And so that's what they do. They tie him up, they bring him to the Philistines, they drop him off. And as Samson arrived at Lehi, the Philistines came shouting in triumph, we finally captured the mighty Samson. But the Spirit of the Lord came powerfully upon Samson, and he snapped the ropes on his arms as if they were burnt strands of flax, and they fell from his wrists. And you can see everybody in the Philistine army just turn and look at this man. He found the jawbone of a recently killed donkey nearby. This is not a skeleton. This is fresh donkey corpse. Stiff, probably infested with flies, reaches down, takes the jawbone and just jerks it right off the donkey. And so once again, Samson breaks his Nazarite vow. Once again, he rips an animal's face open. And he picked it up and killed 1,000 Philistines with it. With that. This is epic, you know. I don't know how this worked. Maybe it was like the Kung Fu movies where they attack one at a time. Maybe the people just, they started, the Philistines just, you know, like with Gideon, they just start attacking each other or something like that. They're thrown into confusion. Regardless, Samson just wipes out 1,000 of these men. And then after he was done, he said, with the jawbone of a donkey, I've piled them in heaps. With the jawbone of a donkey, I've killed 1,000 men. And so like Deborah, Gideon composes a little song to commemorate his victory. But unlike Deborah, there's no mention of God here. It's about what Samson did, not about what God did. And also unlike Deborah, this is not a joyful celebration with the whole tribe, all of the people, celebrating God's victory. This is Samson just kind of singing to himself, all alone, all by himself, nobody around. You know, and he's probably just kind of murmuring and singing to himself as he tosses the bodies up into piles, and waits for the adrenaline to wear off and the emptiness to come back. Samson's a lonely guy. When he finished his boasting, he threw away the jawbone, and the place was named Jawbone Hill. And finally, Samson was now very thirsty, and he cried out to the Lord, "You've accomplished this great victory by the strength of your servant. Must I now die of thirst and fall into the hands of these pagans?" And so what we see Samson do here is something he hasn't done yet the whole time. He prays. He turns to God. Samson is driven, you know, it sounds kind of pious at first. You know, God has accomplished this great victory, but before he finishes the sentence, he goes back to taking credit for it by the strength of your servant. And just like everything else in Samson's life, this prayer really at its heart is self-serving and really just driven by his own appetites. And yet, we see God at work here. We see God finally breaking through to Gideon, engineering circumstances in his life to a point where he's actually willing to turn and call out to God. He's actually willing to open communication with the God of the universe. Something we haven't seen from Samson before. And, you know, it seems like he's got to get pushed to the point where he's about to die before he'll turn to God. But at the very least, a victory has been won here, not just for Israel, but also in Samson's life. God is working his plan with Samson. And God answers his prayer. He caused water to gush out of a hollow in the ground at Lehi, and Samson was revived as he drank. And Samson judged Israel for 20 years during the period when the Philistines dominated the land. And so, you know, I'm not sure what his judgeship looked like. It says the Philistines still dominated the land. You know, maybe there was just an intimidation factor where they backed off for a little while. They were a little bit more scared to move into Israel because they were worried about waking the beast. God worked through a guy like Samson. Okay, let's put some conclusions on this. In summary, what we've seen here is one, Samson did what was right in his own eyes. And when Samson wanted something, nothing else mattered. Casting his family aside, plunging into a poor marriage decision, and then just as quickly casting her aside, in his vengeance, doing whatever he felt, and with his vow. You know, he's got two strikes on him right now. The only thing he hasn't done yet is cut his hair. He's doing what's right in his own eyes, and it builds and builds, and it ends in disaster. And yet at the same time, if God can love Samson, he can love you. Samson was a guy who never followed God. Samson was a guy that just did whatever he wanted, and he would only turn to God in the darkest hour, and yet God still loved him. God was still there, watching over him, protecting him, working in his life, using him, and also trying to break through to him. And finally, if God can work through Samson, he can work through you. I don't know if you ever feel just too messed up, too unprepared, too stupid, too weak, not disciplined enough, not outgoing enough to be used by God. None of those things are obstacles if God can work through somebody like Samson. That's one of the things that really sticks out in this story is God accomplishing his plan, God accomplishing his will in spite of the weakness and frailty of his people. And God can do the same thing in your life. Okay, let's pray. God, thank you that you didn't retaliate against us when we rebelled against you, when we hurt you. But instead, you took things into your own hands. You forgave first. Thank you, Lord, that the cross is the end of retaliation and vengeance. And that's where true forgiveness begins. I pray that we would not be so foolish to run the other way and to say no to you when you're trying to speak to us, Lord. But at the same time, I know that we're going to continue to say no to you, and I thank you for your grace. And I pray that stories like this would just cause us to be more in awe of your forgiveness and love and your power to work through messed up people like us. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted. You may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.